Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. It's a sunny summer day in 1986 in the suburbs of northern Chicago. A six-year-old boy sits in the backseat of his mom's car. The boy is excited because his mom is driving him to a local breeder to pick up their brand new purchase, two Siamese cats. But the boy is about to be even more excited. As his mom pulls into the parking lot of a gas station to fill up, the boy's eyes go wide when he sees a familiar sports car parked at a pump. Mom, that's a DeLorean! The boy's mom smiles as her son marvels at the stainless steel DMC-12. She knows her son is crazy about the DeLorean sports car. He has been ever since the film Back to the Future came out last year. The boy watches with envy as the car's owner steps out of the gull-wing door and starts pumping gas. Mom, do you think he'd let me sit in it?
Well, we'd have to ask permission.
Can we, Mom? Please? All right, come on. The mom takes the boy by the hand and walks him over to the owner of the car.
Excuse me, sir.
Yes? She nudges the boy.
Go on, ask him.
Nervously, the boy squeaks out his question.
Can I sit in it?
Sure thing.
Really?
Yeah, really. Yeah, hop in, kid.
The boy smiles from ear to ear as he leaps into the driver's seat. His head doesn't even reach the top of the steering wheel. But the boy doesn't care. With a big grin, he puts his hands on the wheel and pretends he's flying down the highway.
What do you think, Tamir?
The boy is so happy he can barely speak, lost in the moment. The mom turns to the owner.
Well, thank you for this. I think you've just made his day.
His day? Look how happy he is. I think I made his life.
The young boy's mom would later say that her son jumped in that car and never jumped out. For young Tamir Ardone, it was the beginning of what would be a lifelong obsession. He would end up driving a DeLorean in high school. He would learn everything he could about the car and the man behind it, growing up to become the world's leading DeLorean expert. And he would use his passion for the subject to frame John DeLorean, not with criminal charges, but with a camera.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. John DeLorean has been called a visionary, a con man, a genius, and a crook. His story has inspired countless books, articles, TV shows, and films, including the hit IFC documentary Framing John DeLorean, produced by our guest Tamir Ardone. Tamir is the head of documentary at XYZ Films. He is considered the world's leading historian on all things DeLorean, the car, the company, and the man. Later, we'll be joined by two of Tamir's collaborators, Sheena Joyce and Don Argott, the award-winning Emmy-nominated co-directors of Framing John DeLorean. But first, we'll talk to Tamir about his 34-year obsession. Tamir Ardon, thank you so much for being with me on Business Movers.
Thank you for having me.
So you, like many Americans, like many people across the planet, first encountered the DeLorean when you saw Back to the Future, and then you hopped into a DeLorean at that gas station. But how did you become such an expert on this subject?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm a car person at heart. Before I could even speak, I was obsessed with Matchbox cars and collected cars and just always been fascinated by automobiles. And this particular one caught my eye at an early age, like you mentioned, because of Back to the Future, then subsequently me seeing one a year later, and really just deciding at that point that this car was going to be a pretty important piece of my life. And the internet was really where the obsession over the history of the DeLorean sort of sprouted. It was in the Wild Wild West early days of the internet that myself and my brother created a website dedicated to the DeLorean. And in doing so, I started collecting historical items about John and the car and sort of became obsessed with trying to get at the real story of not only the car, but the company and the man behind the car.
Well, there certainly is a story behind the car and the man. When you were first so intrigued, it was clearly the design of the car, the appealing, sleek, stainless steel futurism of it. But what did you know about John DeLorean back when you started?
Well, I just knew what I was reading in the newspapers and articles that I was sort of collecting off of eBay and the various little pieces of media that were done on him up until that point that I could get my hands on. And then it was basically that he was a renegade, sort of entrepreneur, businessman, with his roots being solely in the car business and sprouting from a young career of being a really brilliant engineer and then sort of shaping his life and his business into creating his own car, which of course then infamously, you know, bursted with the whole drug bust and then subsequently his later life, which is where I sort of picked up meeting him when he was sort of grasping to his last straws of his estate and any finances that he still had left.
Well, you mentioned meeting him, but you just cold called him. You picked up the phone and dialed. How did that happen? Did he pick up?
So yeah, it was actually 1999. I purchased a DeLorean 3 years before, 2 years before, and had been building the website. And I was heading out to New Jersey for a family reunion. And it was the first time I was going to be out in New Jersey. And I knew that he was only about an hour away from where I was going to be. So I looked up his phone number. It was on the internet, shockingly enough at that time. And I called him up. And I remember he picked up the phone and I realized I probably had about 10 seconds before he was either going to hang up on me or take a liking to me. And I was very nervous. My voice was kind of trembling. And he picked up, he said, "Hi, this is John." You know, and I said, "You know, this is who I am. I'm a young fan of yours. I own a car. I've built this website. I'm going to be out there. I'd love to meet you if you're up for it." And he said, "Oh, that'd be great. Give me a call when you're out here and I'll have you out at the estate and we can chat." So 2 weeks later, I was out there and true to his word, you know, he invited me over and that was sort of the first encounter with John.
So that was the first, but after you connected with John, you developed something of a friendship with him and his children. What was it like as a young man with a website befriending a personal hero, the subject of your passion?
Yeah, it was pretty surreal. I mean, it was great. I would correspond with him, you know, not a ton, seldomly through either letters or occasional phone calls. And then I did see him again about a year and a half later at a DeLorean car show, which was the only one he ever attended. And his children are the ones that I really picked up a stronger relationship with throughout the years before his death. And then subsequently after his death, I developed a pretty strong relationship with both Zach and Catherine. And, you know, it was interesting. It was fun to develop those relationships and sort of get a little bit more of an insider information on John and sort of his story.
So John was certainly a charming man. He was a brilliant engineer and an entrepreneur. He had a real talent for selling himself and his vision. That talent helped him to the top of GM. But it was probably John's Hollywood style that made him something of an outsider at GM. If John was such a bad fit for GM, though, in the end, Why do you think he rose to the top? Why did they keep promoting him?
Well, they kept promoting him for a few reasons. I mean, one, he was amazing at his job. And the results were that everyone there was making a ton of money. I mean, he's set records there that still stand till today. I think 1972, 3 million cars sold at Chevrolet, which is a record that's never been broken since. So he kept getting promoted for those reasons. It wasn't necessarily that he was a bad fit for GM. GM just didn't appreciate his outlandish sort of personal style. They were a very sort of clean-cut, company-driven. Everyone has to work for the company, not for themselves. And John didn't necessarily think that way. And that's where they sort of rubbed each other the wrong way. But as long as he was making them a ton of money, they were obviously going to keep someone like that around until it got to the point where he was so far up in the company that he had less autonomy over his own divisions, and he started rubbing the higher-ups the wrong way on a day-in and day-out basis. And that's where things sort of collided, and GM decided to let him go.
Now, you met John DeLorean 15 years after the fact here, but I'm curious to know, how did you find him? I mean, was this renegade spark still with him?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was a charming guy in and out. That didn't stop until he passed. I mean, I remember even when he opened the door, he immediately started sort of hitting on my mom. He's like, oh, who's this good-looking lady over here? I mean, it was hilarious. The guy had that Bill Clinton effect where it didn't really matter if you kind of knew he was a little shady. If you were hanging out with him, you were going to have a fun time and enjoy your time with him. And that's kind of how I always felt whenever I was chatting with him.
Did that charm ever make you feel uncomfortable, more uncomfortable than perhaps him hitting on your mother?
No, not at all. No, I never felt uncomfortable with John. I mean, he was a hero of mine, but I don't put heroes up on a pedestal. So I see the all angles to every, individual out there and their flaws. And I can appreciate those and at the end of the day, just try and understand them and understand where they're coming from and why they made the decisions they did.
Well, speaking of decisions that John DeLorean made, he made a big one when he left GM. He started the DeLorean Motor Company. Every business starts with some sort of idea, and John had a bold one. He wanted to produce the sports car of the future, make it affordable, durable, and mass-produced. So this was exciting for him and exciting for the world, but John couldn't deliver it. This was a man who could, in other circumstances, was as we just mentioned, a storied engineer and executive at GM, but he couldn't do it here. What do you think went wrong?
Well, that question's actually not accurate. He did do it. He made the car. It wasn't necessarily the car that both him and Bill Collins, the lead engineer on the project, set out to make, which was a much more ambitious, ethically oriented safety car that would have had airbags and anti-lock brakes and much, much more innovative safety aspects. But they did make a car. They made it in record time, in a time period where it was very difficult to raise the capital and find a location to make a mass-produced car. Because that's something that people need to understand. He wasn't setting out to make a specialty car like a Ferrari or a Lamborghini where they only make a few hundred cars a year. He was looking to make 30 to 40,000 cars a year, mass-produced scale. And he did that in record time, 2.5 years in Belfast from a totally green field. They built a new factory and in tandem designed the car and productionized the car with Lotus. And for all intents and purposes, the car was actually really good. It had a few quality issues when it first came out, but he accomplished it. Now, on the second part of the question, why did it fail? Well, that's a part that's the interesting element to this. There was a few aspects, and without going too deep into it, a lot of it was built on John's own ambition to succeed too quickly. And the other one was built on just a bad time period to be coming out with a sports car with the early 80s recession. There was a bad winter when it first got launched. So there was a lot of challenging factors that went into it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Well, this probably brings up the central question, you know, the success of him and the failure of the car ultimately, and your feature documentary, which kind of explores John DeLorean's rise and fall. It's called Framing John DeLorean. We already know that you're a longtime fan of the car and the man, but tell us how your film project came together.
Yeah, so the film project was a pretty long and epic battle to get this film made. It just randomly happened to be that I entered the film industry in 2004 by going to UCLA's producing program. And while there, I had ambitions to try and make a DeLorean film. And that was going to be either in the form of a documentary or also a scripted feature film, which ultimately we tried to also make at XYZ Films in the mid, 2006, 2007. It wasn't until 2009, I believe, when I met Don and Sheena, whom I had just seen their amazing documentary, The Art of the Steal, did I really push the pedal to the metal in terms of deciding these were the filmmakers that I needed to help bring this story to life in a way that was going to be really compelling and really interesting to a wider audience. And that was when we started chatting about the project. It would obviously be several years, more until we actually got off the ground and started making it. But that was sort of the impetus for the beginnings of this project and this collaboration between all of us.
Well, this is a good opportunity to introduce our other guests, Sheena Joyce and Don Argut, the co-directors of Framing John DeLorean. Sheena and John, welcome to Business Movers.
Hello.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Sheena, let's start with you. How did you and Don get connected with this film?
Well, as Tamir said, we first met around the time of the Toronto Film Festival when we were screening our film, The Art of the Steal. And we knew Tamir's partners and were introduced to him. And at that time, he was actually in the middle of trying to make the narrative feature of the John DeLorean story and was talking to me and Don about doing the kind of documentary companion piece. And as you see in the film, if you get a chance to watch it, I hope you do, that project goes away. And so we always kept in touch with Tamir. So when the narrative feature went away, our doc went away. And it wasn't until years later that we kind of hooked up again and decided, you know what, well, feature or not, there's something about this guy that deserves a documentary. There's something about him that makes Hollywood obsessed. There were lots of competing projects, but no one succeeded. No one could crack the code. So what is it about this guy that's so compelling that people want to know his story, but why can't anyone figure out the best way to tell it?
Well, talking about the best way to tell it, so it's interesting that you started with the ambition to make a narrative film because you used reenactments in your documentary. That's something that makes this film unique, I think. And we do too, actually, in our show Business Movers. How did you decide that that was the way to tell the story?
Yeah, I mean, it was really a culmination of how the amount of time that we spent going all the way back to 2009 and meeting Tamir and talking about this project. And then, all these years later, kind of reimagining what this thing could be. It was always bubbling in the surface, as Sheena said, this idea of like, why can't anybody figure out how to tell this story? It's intriguing. There's so many great elements to it, but maybe like the straight documentary is just not the best format. But what else can we do to, bring new life into this idea? There had been some TV documentaries that have told, kind of the straight story of what the rise and fall of John And we weren't interested in you know, basically doing an updated version of that. So we wanted to challenge ourselves and also feel like it was an interesting element to lean into the narrative approach that Hollywood seemed to be so obsessed with. There was these multiple competing projects happening at the same time, everybody trying to get this John DeLorean project made, and then nobody was able to do it. So that really kind of gave us the, you know, the idea to not just lean into the documentary approach, but also bring in this narrative element. And then, you know, as luck would have it, it kind of all goes back to 2009. We had a film called The Art of the Steal in the Toronto Film Festival, which ended up doing very well and has become a very well-revered film, you know, after it came out. And one of the fans of that film was Alec Baldwin. And he had reached out to us and told us how much he loved the film and how much, you know, he admired our work and would love to find a project to work on together. And, you know, in this business, timing's everything. And this happened to be a situation where we had access to somebody as incredibly talented and famous as Alec Baldwin. And we knew that if we were going to do a narrative element, having somebody that was just kind of a lookalike or, you know, just a good actor who looked a lot like John wasn't really going to cut it for what we were looking to do. So we started engaging with Alec and talking about the ideas that we had for this thing. And, you know, as luck would have it, he turns out to have had a connection with John, that John had reached out to him probably around the time that Tamir met John, like later, very, very late in John's life, because there was projects back then when he was still alive of a film project potentially happening. And Alec had gotten a call from John DeLorean saying that he wanted him to play him in the film. So it was just all kind of too good to be true. And so it was one of those weird moments where all the stars align, which doesn't happen a whole lot of times. And this was one of those.
I'll just add that, you know, we were having such interesting conversations about John and his life and his story. And as Don mentioned, it wouldn't be fair to have someone who was, I think, unknown playing John, because we were making this argument that he was larger than life. He was a movie star / rock star in his industry. So we needed someone that had that kind of weight and gravitas behind them. Additionally, we were having amazing conversations with Alec about John. And Alec is a really, really smart guy who was asking interesting questions about John and his motivation. And then we got the idea, well, I wonder if we can incorporate this exploration of John's character with the actors into the documentary. So we started rolling behind the scenes too, which made a miserable editing experience for us, but I think ultimately a much better film that we incorporated the behind the scenes, the documentary, and then the narrative scenes to complete a picture of John as I think we could.
One thing that you did, and this goes back to something you said, is you didn't want to modernize an old story of the rise and fall of John DeLorean. You didn't name the film that. Instead, you called it Framing John DeLorean. Why did the team choose this title?
It's a good question. I mean, we struggle. Sometimes titles to films come very easy, and sometimes they are a struggle at the end. This was, I would say, more of the latter. It was hard to, you know, we had DeLorean, we had John DeLorean, we had John Z DeLorean. You know, we had all the ideas that were the most obvious. And then, you know, you start playing around with different, you know, kind of double entendre type things. And I think our editor, Demian Fenton, was the one that had suggested Framing John DeLorean. And, you know, it was one of those ones where we heard it, our ears kind of pricked up, and we're like, huh, maybe let's keep that around, you know. And then the more that we, you know, kept thinking about it, obviously it has, you know, multiple meanings. There's, you know, he is framed in the film in terms of, you know, literally by the FBI. And then there's also this idea of like framing who this guy is from a, you know, kind of film, using a film term standpoint of, you know, framing a shot or something like that. So it seemed to really encapsulate the uniqueness of what we were trying to do with the film. It wasn't just a straight biopic. It wasn't just, you know, it has experimental elements to it. So I think that we needed the title to reflect that in some way. And we settled on that as the title.
And we were also thinking about the frames through which we were viewing John, whether that was from former business partners, friends, his children. Everyone had a different version of John DeLorean in their lives. And he was such a multifaceted person that did a great job of compartmentalizing. You know, we wanted to make sure you could see that you could be both an ambitious, often ruthless businessman, but a great dad too. And I think that the frames through which we view people was part of the title as well.
So after the release of the film, how was it received by the DeLorean family?
Well, what was nice about the film was obviously we had the participation of a lot of the family members, most important being his two children, Catherine and Zach. And fantastically and luckily enough, they both loved the film. And it was, I think, for them a very cathartic sort of process to not only do the interviews with us, but also to watch the film and watch the sort of complete story as told by the folks that actually either lived it with John at various stages of his life that they were not aware of certain facts and certain aspects, and to see it all put into one cohesive sort of 2-hour story was very satisfying for them. And then Catherine actually joined us for the premiere in New York at the Tribeca Film Festival. And, you know, Alec was very excited to meet her and vice versa. And it was a nice moment for us to be able to celebrate it all together. And I think it was really well received by them.
Yeah, it's always difficult, you know, making documentaries, knowing that these are real people and they're sharing their real stories. And, you know, we consolidate that into, you know, an hour and a half, hour, 40 minute film that, you know, you sometimes when you're making it, you lose sight of the fact that, you know, these are real people and these are real emotions and, you know, somebody's real life that, you know, we're using to tell the story. And so it's always nerve-wracking. And the best compliment you can get is when, you know, the family sees it and feels like you got it right and you did it justice and, you know, it was told the right way. So that's something that we never take for granted, you know, knowing that we have this responsibility to tell people stories. You know, you don't want to whitewash anything. You don't want to gloss over things, to spare feelings here and there. And it's just important that, you know, when people do see it, that on the inside, they can look at it and be proud of it, as opposed to like, yeah, I don't want anybody to see that. So it meant a whole lot that the kids who shared so much of their stories with us both felt that we got it right.
I think what surprised me the most was, his ex-wife, Christina, didn't want to appear on camera, but I would say she was a friend of the film behind the scenes. She spoke extensively to Marina Bachran, who portrayed her in our narrative scenes, you know, but John is still the father of her children, and she kind of didn't want to go on camera and be disparaging about him. When the film screened in Los Angeles, though, she came with Howard Weitzman and with her daughter and spoke to Don and I after the screening and said, you know, you guys nailed it. You got John. That was absolutely him. And it brought me back to that moment in time. And I think it built some bridges for the family, too. I think that, you know, Catherine in particular didn't want to ask her mom too much about that time because she knows how painful it was. And I think it opened the door for some conversations that the family had been wanting to have for a while. And so it's funny when you make documentaries, you never really know the ripple effects that your film could have. And certainly there were some surprising effects from our film.
Well, certainly you have experienced and examined John DeLorean from all sides. You know John DeLorean as a businessman, the man, and I suppose as the criminal. He's been called everything, a genius, a visionary, a crook, a con man. But who was the real John DeLorean?
The real John DeLorean, it's a good question. I mean, as Don and Sheena just mentioned, and why the title of the film is so unique is because there's no one John DeLorean. There's multi-personalities of John. And to sum them up into one or two words is not the easiest thing to do in the world. I mean, I'd say John was out for number one, which is himself, in all elements of his life. That's not to say that he didn't have deep love for his family. That's not to say that he didn't have respect and appreciation for those around him in his business life that helped him, you know, get to where he was. But at the end of the day, John was definitely interested in image, interested in his name and what he could make of it. You know, John before the likes of Trump or anyone else that we know in the modern day world of this notion of branding themselves and their image and their name. He was the pioneer of that. His name was synonymous with success, and that's how he was able to trade on his past accomplishments with trying to get his future ones made, the DeLorean car being the ultimate sort of story of one's ability to sort of persuade people, whether that's individual investors or governments, into buying into his dreams. And so I guess if there were one word to describe him, he was a dreamer. I mean, that was John's personality, and it took on different iterations of that throughout his life.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Well, this is a business show, so I'd like to talk about what the modern business person or entrepreneur could learn from John DeLorean and not just to not get entangled in the American drug trade. What are the big business lessons in the John DeLorean story?
My feeling is that every creative endeavor, every business endeavor starts with an idea, a dream, somebody that wants to accomplish something. And, you know, I think what happens more often than not is you get wrapped up in that dream and you kind of lose sight of a lot of other things. And that's inevitable to have happen when you're chasing something that you're so passionate about and you really want to make things happen at all costs. And I think that the lesson is always that, you know, it's like you have to know your lines, you have to know your boundaries and how far you're willing to go. I mean, you know, there's a lot more people like John DeLorean that maybe have just not gotten caught yet for doing the shady stuff that they have done to get where they are. So it really is a cautionary tale of like not letting your dreams consume you to the extent that you lose sight of morality and the other things that, you know, that inevitably happen when you're presented into a situation where all doors have closed on you except the one door that you know is the wrong door, but they're offering you what you need. And again, I don't think John's story is unique in the business world in the sense that there are a lot of people that do nefarious things or illegal things. They just don't get caught as much potentially. We only know the stories of the people like John who did get caught. But I think that's the lesson is just in that, you know, you have to know when to say, I've gone too far. I got to walk this back and reassess here.
The lesson for me was stay in your lane. Just because you're good at one thing doesn't mean you're good at all things. And I think that John's a great example of, you know, he was a genius engineer and marketer. We certainly saw that throughout his life, definitely while he was at GM, look at what he created. But he had a corporate structure around him then. And just because he was a brilliant engineer and a brilliant marketer didn't mean he could also be a brilliant businessman. And I think not getting ahead of yourself, being aware of your limitations and staying in your lane while surrounding yourself with people who are more capable in areas that might not be your strong suit is the biggest piece of advice that I got from learning about John and his story.
And what about you, Tamir? What do you think we can learn from John DeLorean?
Yeah, I mean, I think Don and Sheena touched on a lot of the important things. I mean, I think for John in particular, in comparing it to modern day business folks, especially when you see a lot of these new IPO kickstart companies, tech companies, where there's really no proven product, and yet they're getting hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars invested into their company. It was not too dissimilar for John in the sense that John lived much larger above his means than he should have at the time that he was doing so. And that's to say that, you know, he sort of wanted to live the success before truly, truly earning the level of success that he wanted to live at. And that sort of bit him in the butt in terms of overspending on personal things. And when it comes to shady decision-making and practices, I think Don is spot on. There's probably a lot of business people out here today and back in the day that just didn't get caught doing certain things. But for John, the biggest problem was the moral versus legal line that he towed. And so the two legal aspects that got him in the biggest trouble are obviously the drug trial, which at the end of the day, he could sort of try and defend himself by saying, hey, I got entrapped here. Even though he knew he was going to be getting money from drug folks, it was supposed to be coming through a legitimate bank. And so in his mind, he was kind of towing that line of, well, I'm getting the money through legitimate banking, even though I know it's shady money. So there was that towing of the line. But when it came to the $18 million that he and Colin Chapman from Lotus funneled off from the original UK grants and loan to help build and design the car, that's part of the sort of John where you get to the underbelly of him sort of figuring out ways to sort of manipulate and behind the scenes enrich himself. And in that particular scenario, while he was found not guilty of that situation, defended by the great Howard Weitzman, who also got him off in the drug trial, that was really a scenario where he should have gotten found guilty for that. And he was just extremely lucky based on poor jury instructions from the judge. And so John, another word to describe John, I think, throughout his life is that he was an extremely lucky guy in terms of his ability to avoid jail time and have certain things fall in the right direction.
Let me ask you to speculate a bit. Let's imagine if John DeLorean was a little more restrained, a little more far-reaching in his strategy, and maybe even had a little more luck. Where would the DeLorean Motor Company be today if he hadn't had to turn to the extraordinary measures he did?
It's an interesting question, and I think in a way it's really hard to answer it on one level because the Back to the Future film, which made the car immortal and arguably probably made it to why we're even talking about it or we had made a film about it to begin with, you know, probably would not have happened necessarily if John wasn't involved in all the kind of the legal stuff that was happening at the time, because as we found out with Bob Gale, who was the writer of the film, they picked the DeLorean because John was kind of in the news and he was like, something that was happening in the moment, and that's where the idea came to. I mean, it's a cool car, obviously, and works. We can look back on it and think that there's no other car that it could have been, but we just don't know. You know, we don't know if John wasn't in the news and his trial wasn't happening, if that idea would have been the idea. So it's, you know, there's all these things that happen in life that you just, you know, one moment sets off a chain reaction of things that end up happening. And, you know, there's no way to kind of look back and say, what if that piece didn't happen? Would things have still been the same? So that's just an interesting thing to think about in general. Like, things might not have turned out. I mean, obviously John, the car is super iconic looking, but without it being in Back to the Future, would we still be talking about it, or would it have the, you know, the appeal that it does? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, Don. Who knows if they would have selected it for the film? Let's assume they had and the company were still in business. I think it would have been the greatest marketing move that any company could have ever hoped for. And, you know, John's aspirations were to build more than just one car. I think the modern day equivalent to John's DeLorean Motor Company is obviously Elon Musk and Tesla. And the launch of Tesla, which happened quietly for all intents and purposes, was very similar to DeLorean in that they wanted to launch using a two-seater sports car, which they did. And in fact, they utilized Lotus for that two-door car, which is exactly like DeLorean, utilizing Lotus to help productionize the car. And then from there, they built out their own sedan and subsequent additional models. And that was always John's hope. And they had a four-door DeLorean, also with four gullwing doors that had already been drawn out and started with the engineering. And even with the two-door car, they had a twin turbo that was in development that was going to be coming out in 1983, which would have taken care of all of the concerns that a lot of people were complaining about in terms of the car's sort of anemic, non-sporty engine. And so who knows what would have happened once the economy started picking up and the car got faster and there was a four-door version and maybe it was in Back to the Future. There might still be DeLoreans on the road today, but we'll never know. That's for sure.
I think there's a lot of what ifs. You know, what if John had made better choices? What if the winter weren't so bad and more people were buying cars at the time that the DeLorean first came out? You know, what if John hadn't insulted the British government? Would Margaret Thatcher have released the rest of the funds that were promised to John from the previous administration? You know, there are so many moments in John's story where he could choose maybe the more conservative path, but certainly the more moral path, and then he just went the other way. So to Tamir's point too, I think there were plans in the works for a much broader DeLorean footprint, and had things been different, I think John would have gotten there.
Thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
That was my conversation with Tamir Ardone, Sheena Joyce, and Don Argot, the producing and directing team of Framing John DeLorean, now available on Hulu and available on AMC Plus starting May 5th. Tamir's latest film, Clay Dream, about the life and work of Will Vinton, Oscar award-winning animator, will be premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival in June of 2021. On the next season of Business Movers, after Steve Jobs was fired by Apple in 1985, he founded a new company called Next and bought an animation studio called Pixar. Years later, Apple purchased Next, bringing Jobs back into the fold, just in time to save the company he founded with the lessons he learned at Pixar. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. From Wondery, this is our final episode of The Myth of John DeLorean for Business Movers. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. If you'd like to learn more about John DeLorean, we recommend Dreammaker, The Rise and Fall of John DeLorean by Ivan Fallon and James Rhodes. My Years with John DeLorean by William Haddad. On a Clear Day, You Can See General Motors by Patrick J. Wright. DeLorean by John Z. DeLorean, and Framing John DeLorean. Directed by our guests, Don Argot and Sheena M. Joyce. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is produced by Stephen Walters. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Ritual Productions and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louie for Wondery.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know business.